Welcome to Camloops Alliance, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Chris, lead pastor here at the church. Our church exists to know Jesus and to make him known. To know Jesus is we want to go deep. To make him known is we want to go wide. This is what we believe biblical Christianity is. This is what it means to follow Jesus. But that's kind of an interesting question. What does it actually look like to follow Jesus? So we have articulated what are the habits, commitments, actions, desires of those of us who follow Jesus. The four words are love, gather, practice, and go. We love God. We love each other. We gather in community. We're going to talk about that next week. We practice the faith, which is this whole sermon series, and we go on mission. This is what we believe it means. So this series is all about practicing the faith. What does it look like to follow Jesus right now? I believe that the way forward in our apprenticeship to Jesus in 2021, we do that by actually looking back. What I mean by that is we ask, how have followers of Jesus followed him in times of difficulty through a pandemic, but also in our secular culture? The way that they've done it is through these practices, not as an end, but as a means to an end, to know Jesus deeply, to love Jesus above all things. And so that's what this is all about. This weekend is simplicity. This is the art of letting go. It is untangling and uncomplicating your life so you can focus in on the things that matter most. Untangling and uncomplicating your life so you can focus in on the things that matter most in your life, like Jesus, like relationships, like the people that are closest to you. So that's the topic. But before we get into this, I'm kind of dancing in the minefields with this topic a little bit. So what I want to do is I want to just set the culture or the tone of this by a few reminders kind of to bring you up to speed. First of all, what I want to say is that guilt-driven obedience doesn't work. The, oh my goodness, I have too many things, I am too busy, therefore now I need to change, has a very short shelf life. It won't last. I mean, I'd give you 3 or 4 days of guilt-driven obedience. And so if by the end of this, you feel guilty, I have not done my job, or you have misinterpreted what I've said, because guilt-driven obedience doesn't work. I remember as a youth pastor, we took our students to a youth conference, and the pinnacle of this youth conference was a well-known speaker basically guilting my students into how much they had. And then the ask at the end of this session was, now would you sponsor a child, you rich, middle-class, white kid, all right, basically. I just want to say, the organization that was sponsoring these kids or telling us, we sponsor them ourselves as a family. So I'm not getting at sponsoring children. That's not the issue. The issue was the motivation behind the sponsoring, because every single one of our students said, oh, you're right, I do spend too much on Starbucks, I'll sponsor a kid, which basically ended up meaning that their parents now have sponsored a child. And so on the way back to our hometown, I got on the microphone in our on the bus, and I basically said to the kids, here's what they meant to say. Because guilt-driven obedience to Jesus smells rotten, and it is rotten. It doesn't work. And so that's not what I'm trying to do. I know none of us right now in COVID-19 need a guilt trip. So please don't hear this as that at all. Second, when we think about simplicity, we often tie this to socioeconomic status or the money that you make. And while some of that is true, this conversation is way broader than just that. So stick with me if you're like, oh great, he's going to talk about money, I don't make enough or whatever. No. It's not just about that. So stick with me. I promise we'll get there. What I love about Camloops Alliance is how different we are when it comes to our socioeconomic status. That our church has people that make a little, and our church has people that make a lot of money, and that doesn't divide us at all. KAC isn't diverse in some ways, ethnically especially, which we want to get better at, but socioeconomically, actually, our church represents all different types of tax brackets, which I think is beautiful. So I know on the other side of that camera that I'm looking at right now, there are many different people who make a little and who also make a lot. This conversation is more than just, it is, but it's more than just about socioeconomic statuses. When it comes to money, especially within Christianity, oftentimes, those who make a lot are kind of looked down upon too. Like, how dare you, if you only would read the words of Jesus, you have to sell everything, give it to the poor, then you wouldn't have as much as you do. But the Bible actually is way more nuanced when it comes to this idea of money and possessions. It's not just about giving everything away, which Jesus does talk about. It's more nuanced. In Dallas Willard's book, The Spirit of the Disciplines, the last chapter is called, Is Poverty Spiritual? It's a great chapter about this topic, about what does it look like in our modern era to follow Jesus with a lot or with little? Is poverty spiritual? And in that chapter, what Willard does is he differentiates having riches and trust in riches. There's a difference about having stuff and riches and then trusting in them. And here's what he says. He says, to trust in riches, on the other hand, is to count upon them to obtain or secure what we treasure most. It is to think that they will bring us happiness and well-being. So it's about trust. Where is your trust? Is it in the stuff that you have? And in this way, it doesn't really matter how much money you have, whether it's a little or a lot, because it's not about what happens on the external. It's about what happens in the internal, because that's where your trust is functionally happening. So you can make a little and still functionally trust in your riches. And I have met great people who have done very well in life, and they leverage their stuff and their money and their possessions for the kingdom of God, and it is beautiful. So that's the second thing I want to just talk about. The third thing is I realize the nuance of this, both in the socioeconomic status that you have, but also your stage of life. This is way different for different people. Like, I know some of you are older in a retirement home, and you're sitting in 700 square feet, and you've given all of your stuff away because you are where you're at. And so this is a different type of conversation for you. I know others, because of COVID-19, man, your business has taken off, and your calendar is more full than it ever has, and your bank account is, and you're growing, and you're buying equipment, and you're expanding. So that's real of you. I mean, I as a parent of young kids, this week was downstairs in our basement, and our kids just made it a disaster. Like, there's just things everywhere. They've dumped over all the bins. So I'm cleaning up all this stuff, and I'm thinking about simplicity, right? And I look at it, I'm like, oh my goodness, like, we have way too many toys for our kids. But then I was like, wait a second. All of these toys were bought by my parents or the grandparents. Like, we didn't even buy this stuff. And so there's some of us too that we've just accumulated stuff because of our young kids. So here's the point of this. I want you to translate this for your own life. Wherever you are, I need you to translate this, because I don't want this to be a guilt trip at all. And it's going to hit you in different ways. And so be gracious to me and translate this for you. Okay, enough. Let's get going about simplicity, or as our culture labels it, minimalism. Our culture is fascinated with this subject. Last year, January, I preached a message on simplicity. And anecdotally, actually, it was one of the most engaging sermons I've ever preached. I mean, that's what you've told me. Numerically, too, people really tuned into that. Why? Because I think you and I know we have way too much. Our calendars have way too much in them. Our houses have way too much in them. We functionally know in our culture that we have so much stuff. This idea of minimalism, even in our culture, pop culture, is huge. 17 million pictures on Instagram have the hashtag minimalism on them. Pop culture, you go to Netflix. There is a documentary, 75-minute documentary on Netflix called Minimalism. Basically, two young professionals who were making six figures realize, wait a second, we're not happy. So they start to live this minimalistic life, this simple life, and they take a Cross America tour and they document it. And you can see that on Netflix now, and it's super prominent and widely viewed. also on Netflix. You probably know this. I haven't watched this. This is kind of like what the wives like to watch, but let's just be honest. There's another documentary called The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up by Marie Kondo, okay? And Marie Kondo, she's Japanese, and she on Netflix talks about how tidying up your space and getting rid of things actually brings you joy. And so she encourages the viewer to take an object in your house and ask yourself, does this thing bring me joy? And if it doesn't, get rid of it. But if it does, you can keep it. And then she goes through, here's how you are to fold your underwear and your t-shirts. And so one day I come home and my underwear drawer, my t-shirt drawer is all different. I'm like, Crystal, what's going on here? She's like, oh, I watched this thing about Marie Kondo and how you're supposed to fold and whatever. But at the heart of it is a simple minimalistic life. Marie Kondo's book sold over 10.5 million copies. I mean, this is everywhere. Reality TV show. There's a TV show called Hoarders, where there's like a literal diagnosed issue that people have, that they just hoard things in their house and there's stuff everywhere. Auction Hunters, another reality TV show. And in Auction Hunters, what they do is they bid on abandoned storage units. And then they open up the storage unit and see what they got. Why? Because everybody needs storage units. Why? Because we have too much stuff. The amount of entertainment at our fingertips with Netflix and TV. I remember as a kid, I would literally have to go up to the TV and I'd have to plug in the channel. And I only had like 15 of them. Now, man, I have like 100 channels and I only honestly watch like 3 of them. We have way too much. Even with technology, there's something called now the light phone. The light phone. And the light phone, the tagline of it is a phone that actually respects you. Because we own smartphones, but here's the reality. Our smartphones actually own us with our attention and our calendars and the notifications. And so the light phone, so fascinating. The light phone, you don't actually have any access to an internet browser. Social media, you're not allowed to have. It's very simple in its design and function. And this is kind of the rage, the new thing. And I look at this phone and I'm like, you know what? That phone is actually like the very first phone that I ever had in 2005. This is everywhere. Personal growth, this book called Essentialism by Greg McKeown, written a few years ago, kind of blew up. Why? Because his argument in the book, which I've read, is that minimalism is a habit of effective people because it's streamlining you to say, I don't do this, I don't do this, I only do these few things. Minimalism is everywhere, including the church. In 2011, there was a book written called Simple Church. And it was written in response to the impulse of evangelical churches like ours to add. We're going to add, we add. And then by the end of it, there's like 350 programs for a church of 50 people. And everybody is burnt out and everybody is too tired. Why? Because we're busy doing things for Jesus, but in doing so, we actually miss Jesus himself. So simplicity, minimalism is everywhere. Why? Because at the heart of it, you and I know we are doing too much, we have too much, we think too much of all of this. So we live in a culture of excess. There's too much. We all know it. Yet at the same time, there's ample everything, but at the same time, there's skyrocketing mental health issues. I mean, even this week was Bell Let's Talk Day, bringing awareness to a great cause of mental health. Greg Easterbrook, a few years ago, wrote a great book called The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. Listen to what he says. Adjusting for population growth, 10 times as many people in the Western nations today suffer from unipolar depression or unremitting bad feelings without a specific cause than did a half century ago. Do you listen to that? That more people in the West now have unipolar depression and just bad thoughts than a half century ago. Here's how he ends this haunting statement. Americans, I would say North Americans, and Europeans have ever more of everything except happiness. We live in a culture of excess. We have things at our fingertips, but here's a problem. We aren't more happy. So why are we talking about simplicity? Is this kind of just a cool cultural thing to talk about? Actually, no, it's not. This is deeply embedded in the teaching, sayings, life of Jesus of Nazareth in the Christian tradition. So instead of looking at culture, I want to look at Christ and what he said, both in his lifestyle, in his teaching, and in his person. So Luke chapter 9, if you have your Bibles, I would love for you to go there with me. Luke chapter 9, verse 57 says this: "As they were walking along the road, a man said to him, 'I will follow you wherever you go.'" In other words, Jesus, I'm all in. Here's what Jesus says. Jesus replied, "Foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." I'm all in. Jesus says, okay, you're all in. He says, look at the foxes. They have dens. Or think about the foxes. They have a place to sleep. Think about a bird. They have a nest to sleep. The Son of Man, which is what Jesus is attributing to himself. It's from Daniel. That title's from Daniel. He says, the Son of Man, me, has nowhere to lay his head. In other words, count the cost. If you really are all in, count the cost of what discipleship or apprenticeship to me actually is. See, the lifestyle of Jesus was one of simplicity. Now, did Jesus have beds to stay in? Yeah, he stayed at Peter's house. He stayed in places. But what he is saying is that following me isn't easy. It's not all what you think it is. It's not about comfort. It's about cost. It's not about getting everything you want. It's actually about surrendering all to follow me in a life of discomfort. This isn't easy. So before you say, hey, I'm all in, I'll go wherever you want me to go, Jesus says, hey, count the cost. If it's easy for you to follow Jesus, in other words, something is up, something reeks in your discipleship to Jesus, because he says it is not easy. And that was true then, and that is true now. If all this is a cruise ship liner for you, no cost to your reputation, no cost to your bank account, we need to listen to the words of Jesus that this is actually difficult. That's, I think, one of the things he's saying. The second thing he says to this wanting disciple, or maybe wannabe disciple, is don't get too comfy here. Don't get too comfy here. You see, there's this really silly line of thinking within some streams of Christianity that you get Jesus and you get a prosperous life. There's actually a book titled, You Can Live Your Best Life Now. Your Best Life Now. The problem with that type of thinking within Christianity is that they actually don't read the words of Jesus, because Jesus here is saying, don't get comfortable. This, you are just passing through this world. It is not about accumulation here. Because eventually you're not going to be able to bring it with you anyway. That Christianity, according to Jesus, is that you don't live your best life now, and that following Jesus is costly and simple. That's his lifestyle, the lifestyle of Jesus. Now, in a few chapters later, in Luke chapter 12, he's now talking to thousands of disciples. There's a crowd that he is talking to. In Luke chapter 12, verse 13, says this: "Someone in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me.'" So somebody yells out, "Hey, Rabbi," which is what rabbis would do. They would teach. He says, "Hey, I want you to come into my family situation and tell my brother to split the inheritance." In other words, I want more. I want my part. Jesus replied, I love his reply, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" In other words, like, I'm not going to go into your family dealings. Like, that's not my place, is what Jesus is saying. Then he said to him, "Watch out. Be on your guard. Pay attention to the thinking or the desire behind your statement," Jesus is saying. He says, "Be on your guard against all kinds of greed." Greed. Or the idea of covetousness. This is the Ten Commandments, of wanting more. The idea of greed is wanting more than your fair share. That's what Jesus is getting at. Wanting more than your fair share. You have enough already. Why do you want more? And that's what Jesus is diagnosing in this question. You already have enough. Why do you want more? You are discontent with what you have. That's what he's pointing out. Then he says, life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. See, he's diagnosing the human heart right now that you want more and more and more. And Jesus is saying, no, no, no. My teaching is that life, good life, the best life, does not consist in the accumulation of possessions. It cannot do it. So I remember when I was in grade four, the coolest kid in my class in grade four, his name was Frankie. And Frankie, I remember this so vividly. Frankie was cool for two reasons. The first reason, that Frankie had a black leather Oakland Raiders hat that I just thought was the best. And I knew that was way outside of my price range. So he had a black leather hat. I mean, what? He's so cool. The second thing I remember about Frankie is that at the time, what was cool was to have really baggy jeans, kind of like straight-legged jeans. So when you stood up, you couldn't see your shoe because it was draping over it. That was like the coolest thing. And so I remember, I'm like, oh man, I need to get cool like Frankie. And so the black leather hat was out of the question, like I said. But I thought, you know what, I won't get jeans like that because my mom would never buy me jeans like that. But I do have Taekwondo pants that look quite similar because at the time I was in Taekwondo. And so I tried on my Taekwondo pants at home and they were straight and they were baggy and they covered my shoes. And so then I was like, okay, but my mom won't let me wear my white Taekwondo pants to school. And so what I did was I hid them in my backpack for an entire week. And then when I'd get to school, I would take off my pants and I'd put on my white Taekwondo pants so I could be cool like Frankie. But it all went really bad one day when I was at recess in my white Taekwondo pants, and I slipped and I fell into a puddle, and then I had to bring my white Taekwondo pants home, and my mom got so mad at me for doing this. But I remember as a kid just looking at Frankie thinking, if I had those things, I'd be cool. Man, if I looked that part, I would be so cool. And so this week, I don't know how this happened, some link on the internet, it was like, hey, look at Tom Brady's mansion. So, you know, he won last week the AFC Championship, which was terrible. So I'm like, I wonder where Tom Brady lives. And so I click on this link and, all these pictures of Tom Brady's mansion. And I think to myself, man, it would be cool to have that. I wonder what it would be like to have all of that. So in grade four, I'm like, I wonder what it would be like to have those things. And then this week, as a 37-year-old dad, I have a wife, I have a mortgage, I'm still thinking, how do I get more stuff? And Jesus says, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. That there is a desire in you and I to get more. That's the way to the good life. I just want another ATV. I just want another thing. I just want more. I just want this. And Jesus is saying in his teaching, listen, it's not about that. It's not about that. But you and I easily buy into it. So that's Jesus's lifestyle, his teaching, and then his person. I love this. In the Gospel of John, talking to his disciples again, he's talking about the bread of life. A lot of connotations, so Old Testament stuff there. Don't have time to get into it, but in verse 34, it says, one of the disciples says, sir, they said, always give us this bread. And they're just thinking about bread that fills their belly. Jesus then answered. He says, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. You see, he's not just talking about bread that fills your belly. He's talking about the desire of the human heart. The desire of the human heart. And he says, look, here's bread that maybe will fill you for a little while, but what you really need is for the endless well of desire to be fulfilled in you. And he gives himself to his followers to say, actually what you need, your desires are actually fulfilled in me. So eating, yes, bread, it's a good and right desire, and you fill it with creation, but you don't fill your soul with created things. You fill it with the Creator. This is what Jesus is saying, because listen, what is a human being? You're not just a product of the hard sciences of synapses in your brain and physical entities. You have a soul, and your soul was created for God. It was created for eternity. So an ATV cool jeans, a bigger house cannot fulfill the deepest longings that you have. Only Jesus can. And I know in our culture, especially in Kamloops, the cultural pull is to have more recreational things in our life. And look, are these things wrong? No. The difference, remember, it's not having them. It's trust in them that they would fulfill the deepest longing of your life. So what Jesus is saying is that your deepest longings, your desires for things and stuff is actually not the way forward. It's actually me. And here's the thing. Is that those who have followed Jesus and taken him at his word when it comes to him fulfilling the deepest longings of our heart, they have learned what it means to actually be happy, to actually have a contentment in their life isn't found in those things. And so you can see one of these instances in the book of Philippians. Paul, one of the earliest followers of Jesus, literally loses everything. He's writing this letter from a Roman prison cell, rotting away. And listen to what he says. He says, I am not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. He's lived both lives. He's had a lot and he's had a little, but listen to what he says. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. The ones who have taken Jesus at his word, his teaching, his lifestyle, his person, have learned to be content. And so for those of us who are buying into this myth that buying things and stuff and having all of these things will actually make me happy, what do you do with that? What do you do with Paul? What a countercultural example of somebody who says, I don't need that. All I need with Jesus. The lie that you and I can believe is that the road to happiness is filled with stuff, when actually the road to happiness is filled with Jesus. This isn't true of a guy like Paul, but even through church history, followers of Jesus have been the people who say, you know what, I don't need things, I don't need stuff, all I need is Jesus. Let me tell you about one of them. There's many, many different movements. I can talk to you about the Puritans. I can talk to you about many different things. I want to give you one example through church history of somebody who said, all I need is Jesus. That's how simple my needs actually are. His name was Francis of Assisi. Francis of Assisi was born in northern Italy to a wealthy merchant family. He grew up in privilege. He was born in 1182. By about 1204, Francis grew completely discontent with his life. There's probably more than what he was experiencing in his life of privilege. One biographer said, he said he squandered his time terribly. Indeed, he outshone all his friends in trivialities. He had everything, comfy, cozy life, until two circumstances changed his life. The first was that Francis went to Rome. And while he was in Rome, the big city, he saw a leper. Not a leopard, a leper on the side of the road begging. And Francis of Assisi, filled with compassion and empathy for this leper on the side of the road, bends down, gives him alms or gives him money, and kisses his sores, completely changing his life. The other instance that changed his life was close to his hometown. He saw a dilapidated church and he heard God say to him, "Restore this church." So Francis, being obedient to what he felt God was saying, went home to his wealthy family and sold some of his family possessions. This infuriated his dad. He was not happy. So Francis's dad brought him to the local bishop and told the bishop to tell Francis to stop and to give the money back. It was in this moment where Francis had a choice to make. Was he going to follow the path of his life or was he going to make a change? And he said in this moment, he says, up until today, he said to his father, I have called you father. But now I can say in all honesty, our Father who art in heaven. In other words, I'm going the way of simplicity. I'm following God. And by doing that, he took off all of his clothes in front of them and left and became a hermit in silence and solitude for the rest of his life. At the heart of the Franciscan movement, he started a movement because of his life. At the heart of it was one of poverty, renouncing wealth and serving the poor. one of the first rules that they came up with in 1221 of how to follow the Franciscan way was this: the friars are to appropriate nothing for themselves, neither a house nor a place nor anything else. They beg for alms trustingly. In other words, they trust God for the care of themselves. So what's the point? Why am I telling you about Francis of Assisi in the 12th century? Is it a normative thing? Is that what I'm telling you to do? No, that's not what I'm telling you to do at all. There are some people that are called to that, but not all of us. Why am I telling you this? Because listen, some of his biographers said, it was said of St. Francis that his band of followers, that they led a cheerful, happy revolt against the spirit of materialism. I love that. A revolt against the spirit of materialism, the lie of consumerism. That's what simplicity is all about. So when you and I practice simplicity, we are rebelling against the spirit of materialism, saying not more is better, but Jesus is better. And I will not find my identity, my happiness, the greatest desire of my life in the accumulation of titles or possessions or things or anything else than Jesus. That is what simplicity is all about. Okay. So what are the ways forward? How do you actually practice this? Knowing who's listening in your varying different spheres, let me trace out a few different things. I offer them gently and humbly. The first thing, what does this actually look like to practice simplicity? The first thing is to look at your things, your stuff. I don't know how much it is. I don't know how full your garage is, if you have a storage space or if you live in a 700 square foot apartment. I don't know. But to look at your stuff and to do a few things. First is to assess your stuff and ask, what do I actually need? What do I actually need? Like, I was super challenged this week as I look at my stuff. What do I actually need? Clothes that don't fit me anymore, that are just hanging in my closet. What do I actually need? And maybe more importantly, to ask the question, as you look at your things, what is it about this that grips me? What is it? Do I leverage it for my identity or my happiness or my joy? What is it that grips you? So you need to assess. Then you need to ask. You need to ask about your things and your stuff or a future purchase. You need to ask, how does this thing, this item, how does it align with my values? How does it align with my values? Because that will help you purchase and consume or buy things that actually help you apprentice Jesus rather than deter you from. So here's an example. When Chris and I got to Kamloops and we knew that we were moving, one of the values that we have as a couple is hospitality. We love having people in our house. The more, the merrier. So one of the values that we had is we want a big space. We want a bigger house. Coming from the Lower Mainland to Kamloops, we were able to do that. We wanted a place where my family and Chris's family and people visiting, stopping, that we had an entire basement that they could just have and enjoy, a spot to rest their head, a warm meal. And so one of the values that we had, we actually used that to purchase a home that we felt would align us with the values that honor Jesus and the people that we love so dearly. So ask that question of yourself as you think about purchasing different things in your life. And then as you think about your stuff, your things, give it away. Give it away before you have consumed it. I remember in Coquitlam when I was pastoring there, oftentimes we would ask for donations for some of our global partners. And people would bring in donations of different things, clothing, boots, and some of it was lightly used and others were brand new. But some of the stuff that we got, it was like nobody would want to wear this. There is no grip on the boots. This is a used pair of underwear. Like, don't give us the scraps. And I think to practice simplicity, when you look at your stuff, don't just use it up and throw it in the landfill here in Kamloops. Give it away to somebody as a blessing and as a gift. That's how you can practice this. The other way is through your time. To simplify. See, this isn't just about things and socioeconomics and money. This is about your time. How do you simplify your calendar? The question is, what have you learned through COVID about your calendar? Because it's been obliterated. The soccer games, the travel teams, the all gone. What has it taught you about your calendar. I think it's taught me a lot. I don't need to do as much as I thought I did. I can simplify my life that I'd have more space. For you parents, I get the pressure to make sure your child, when they leave your house, are as set up for success as possible. So they are expert piano players and they can shoot a hockey puck and they're good at soccer and they chase a Div 1 scholarship and they know how. I get all of that. They can speak Mandarin, whatever it is. I get the temptation. But what is the cost of them doing all of those things but not knowing Jesus? What's the cost of doing that? How do you simplify your calendar? The haunting thing for me as a parent, as I look at my kids grow up, is I only have a certain amount of time with them. Then I say, toodaloo, good luck in the world. I want to leverage all the time I possibly can one-on-one, not with them at a soccer game, not with them at a piano teacher, although good and right, and we are doing that. But I want to disciple them. I want to teach them to love Jesus. I want them to know what it is to be a good human being in our world. And that's time with me, not just farming them out to different experts. What does it look like to simplify your goals? And I'm talking now to the type A's, get it done, success oriented. What does it look like to simplify your goals? I think oftentimes we occupy ourselves with things way too beautiful or grand for us. And we forget about us as just fragile human beings. And some of our goals, some of your goals right now, are driving you at the cost of some of the most important relationships in your life. So great, you make a great business and it's succeeding, but yet your wife doesn't know your name and your kids don't know who you are. Like, it doesn't make sense to do that. So what does it look like to simplify, not get rid of, but simplify your goals? Maybe instead of having 30, you have 3. What about your words? This is how you practice simplicity. What about your words? I'm married to somebody who's very thoughtful with their words, more passive in conversation, amazing, beautiful human being. I'm more verbose. I like to tell stories, as hopefully you can tell. So when we first got married, we had a collision because Chris is also very detail-oriented. She knows the number exactly, whereas I will generalize things. And so we'd be out at a social gathering, and I'm working the crowd, you know? People are laughing, and I'm telling a story, and I exaggerate this detail here, and I say more here. And then we'd be driving home, and Chris is like, it didn't happen that way. I'm like, so what, you calling me a liar? It wasn't good. In our first few years of marriage, I had to learn accuracy matters, that the more words I say, actually, the more I get into trouble. So I think one of the ways that we can practice this is let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't exaggerate. Simplify the words that you say. And at least as I'm learning, it'll keep you out of trouble. What does it look like for you to simplify the media in your life? The media intake in your life. I think all of us need to have some limiters when it comes to media and technology in our lives. Let me give you an illustration of just me in the last little while. So it was like October, November of the fall. I'm on Twitter. I had a Twitter account, and I'm on Twitter, and I'm following Beth Moore, who is an evangelical teacher in Texas, and I'm following her, and she's spouting off something about Donald Trump. And so I click on this tweet, and then there's like, you know, 8,000 different responses to her, and this is, you know, really criticizing her or encouraging her, and it's just this long, deep rabbit trail of the worst of the internet. And I'm scrolling, reading all of these comments and hate towards Beth Moore. And then afterwards, I was like, I have enough problems of my own. I don't need to know what Beth Moore thinks about Donald Trump right now. And I don't need to know about whatever this random person thinks about what Beth Moore thinks about Donald Trump. Like, this is insane. I have my own life. So after that, I'm like, I'm out. I can't do this anymore. So I simplified my life. And I got rid of my Twitter account, and I have been the better for it. What does it look like for you to simplify some of your media intake? Technology. I heard from another pastor, his name is John Mark Comer. He uses this phrase when it comes to technology, when it comes to your phone. He's like, make your smartphone dumb. And I love that. Make your smartphone dumb. This is an upstream practice for me, simplicity. There are some things in my life that I think I'm doing okay. There's other things that I still have desire that isn't ultimately fulfilled in Jesus. But one of the things that I have done well, especially coming into this role as a lead pastor, when it comes to my phone, is I came here and I said, I will not put my work email on my phone. I just won't do it. So when I have my phone and it's my day off, it is impossible for me to get an email. And that has been so good for me to do. What does it look like for you to simplify it? Or Sabbath, like we talked about last week, and put your phone away to simplify the notifications in your life. Another thing I've heard to make your smartphone dumb is to grayscale it. What that means is instead of having a color screen, you actually just grayscale it. And you can do that in the settings. And it's neurologically proven that without color, pictures, videos, it's not as exciting to look at. And so you naturally don't look at your phone as much. And I have been trying to do that over the last few years, to grayscale my phone, to make my smartphone dumb. Maybe to simplify your life this week just simply means this. Instead of listening to a podcast, the radio, music in your car, on your commute, you just drive in silence, and you're alone with your thoughts, and you can pray, and you can reflect on your day. You can prepare yourself to go home to your family, what the evening's going to take, putting your kids to bed. Maybe that, just shutting off noise to be alone. That's simplicity. Simplicity is untangling and uncomplicating your life so you can focus in on what really matters. It's cultivating the art of letting go. And I think in our culture right now, this is a mandatory, I hope at some level, practice for all of us. You can think of practicing the art of simplicity as gain through loss. It's counterintuitive that by saying no to that goal or saying no to that commitment or saying no to that extra piano lesson or thing, it's gain through loss. Why? Because when you simplify your life, you lose something, but you gain time. You gain money. You gain quiet. You gain time. So yes, it is hard to let it go, but oh man, what you get in return when you focus in on Jesus as the end, the means is simplicity, the end is Jesus. What you get in return far outweighs what you will lose. And practicing simplicity now will prepare you for what will inevitably happen then. Because the end of your life, you will have nothing. You will have nothing. There are no U-Hauls behind hearses. I saw a funeral. I saw a funeral thing happen today. There is no U-Haul behind the hearse. That practicing simplicity now will prepare you for what it will inevitably happen then. So now is a time where we focus in on Jesus. I remember when I lived in a condo, when I first got married to Chris, I lived in a condo. And near the garbage place where the recycling was, the garbage was, there's kind of like this like dump zone that wasn't really a dump zone. People would bring their like rear projection TVs down there and their bookshelves down there. And it became kind of this magnet for the things that people didn't want. All of the excess, all of the old stuff, they just would put it there and hope that somebody would get rid of it for them. I don't know who's going to get rid of it. In other words, I want somebody to get rid of the stuff that I don't know what to do with. And this is us with our physical stuff. What do we do with all these things? Here's the reality. Is that, yeah, we have stuff that we have in our lives, but there's stuff that we have in our souls. And there is a place where you can bring that stuff, the greed, the covetousness in your life. This empty hole that you have when you look at the excess of your life and you're still discontent. And his name is Jesus. And in his lifestyle and in his teaching and most importantly in his person, he offers you satisfaction. that we wouldn't find ourselves and our identity in our stuff, but in Jesus. So what does this look like for you?